Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming in the middle of an electronic force field, it seems, sound field. My name is Peter Wintonik. I think we'll be getting some stragglers coming in because of another major event was just finishing at 1:30, the DOC summit at the industry center there. I'm with a small production company called Necessary Illusions in Montreal. I'm one of the co-founders of the DOC of Gora, kind of roving gypsy digital conference, along with Amit Brr, who's a producer from Canada and Israel, Fleur Noppertz, formerly with the ITFA International Co-Financing for International Documentary, the Forum in Amsterdam is what we call it, and now working with DocFest in Sheffield, England. Cameron Hickey, we call the web jockey, but he's actually a documentary filmmaker working out of Philadelphia with Pattern Films, developing many kind of new media iterations of the documentary experience. And today he will be negotiating and arguing with the Apple computer, it seems. It's going to be a kind of high technology versus low technology experience because somehow a cup of coffee was spilled upon the keyboard. And we'll see who wins that argument. Agora in Greek, and Cameron would know because he's of Greek descent, means marketplace, a kind of in the, just below the Acropolis there in Athens. We went to visit a place and sort of got inspired to create a documentary version of that meeting place and marketplace, and really motivated by the desire to bring the old technologies face to face with the new technologies. Getting inspired by people like Neil Sealing here, who will be one of our moderators and has also joined this kind of DOC Agora collective of contributors. We're a nonprofit organization and we're really like a band of gypsies parachuting into real life festivals like Amsterdam and Sheffield and now Hot DOC. So for their hosting of this event, I really would like to thank Brett Hendry and Chris McDonald and Jen Hobbs, who have helped us arrange space and helped us get you here, along with the CBC Digital Division of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, who are sponsoring, along with the documentary organization, this event. Really, the purpose of DOC Agora is to look at new forms and new platforms and new ways of financing what we call a socially engaged and creative documentary content. We would stop at the word documentary, but we're talking about a fuller and wider spectrum of definition, I think, for the kind of digital documentary, the documentary of the future. It's also a way, I think, of deprogramming ourselves from programmers and cutting off or maybe widening the possibilities for financing to bring our colleagues from the commissioning world in broadcasting closer to their own digital divisions within the same broadcasters, or to bring all of us together into this DOC Agora kind of tent and to develop eventually kind of new ways of financing documentary, which may be happening at places like Michelle's Toronto Documentary Forum, but also augmented perhaps by the possibilities of raising money online for specific projects and programs. So we're, as I say, a kind of feast of fools trying to understand all of this confusion and welcome to you. And I will welcome now the moderator of the I welcome now Sarah Diamond, who is, I find, my spiritual mother and colleague, who was the head of the Banff New Media Institute of Banff Center of the Arts for many years, for a dozen years, really. But before that was a documentary filmmaker making video art and around struggle and women's issues and unions. But she's doing all sorts of wild things, essentially working with programmers. programmers programming the future, I think. And recently she was named president of the Ontario College of Art and Design here, one of the oldest art schools in the world. And she's transforming those young minds into people who could come to the Doc Agora as a full-time experience. Sarah Diamond.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for being here today. I thought I would try and, excuse me, hack my way through this, figuratively. But I thought I would try and talk about really three things to set up the discussion today. So the first is a conversation about oscillations in the nature of control, particular post 9/11. The second is changes in the experience and structure of time as lived experience in terms of media and in terms of daily life in the 21st century, because time, after all, is our medium as documentary makers. And the third is the cultural move from participatory inquiry in documentary as something that's either autorial or something that's sort of about collaboration, to increasingly a culture of participation, including user-generated content and the kind of shift that represents. While I speak, depending on the will of the wetware now in the computer, we're going to do some parallel processing. So I've done a kind of indiscreet choice of hybrid media, text, video, etc., that are kind of illustrative of some of what I'm saying and give you, I think, a sense, I hope, as we move through the 15 minutes or so, of some of the examples, some of the sort of challenges and excitement in how documentary is moving. So first of all, to talk about issues of distributed control versus command and control, I mean, we're in a very contradictory moment here, I think, and by here I mean in this sort of global context. There's no question that spectacle, you know, the kind of culture which is very much about watching and the culture of the kind of downside of reality television, perhaps, or the kind of seduction of it, and voyeurism has certainly increased with the webcam and now mobile phone capabilities and a very dramatic and rapid uptake of reality television. Sorry. This will end. Okay, in the early 21st century, and there's some really interesting sort of academic writing right now, equally contradictory about reality television, of academics who, you know, are really seduced by it and who are kind of horrified by it. But it's a very important sort of moment, I think. And you know, Peter Wintonek, of course, has made a very critical film that sort of looks at that path from Verite. We also have video streaming and chat over the web, which has become really ubiquitous. But it also involves citizen dialogue and documentation of political concerns, sociable media, which is another way of talking about user-generated content, and the sharing and altering of cultural products through file sharing and VJ-DJ culture. And we're going to look here at a mother from Gaza, if you don't mind putting that blog up here. And we're going to navigate through some of this material as I talk, and I'm not going to speak to it until at the end. But at the same time, technologies are increasingly ubiquitous, as I mentioned, and also biologically invasive. So since 9/11, we've seen the absolute rampant uptake of CCTV everywhere. And RFID tags, which if you don't know what they are, they're basically memory tags that can follow you through all kinds of systems, allow the movement of humans to be monitored in real time as well as after the fact. So, oh good, things are working here. when you're finished navigating that, if you can go to the surveillance camera players, who are a very interesting group that are kind of dealing with a sort of dialogue with CCTV, and who they're addressing, and you'll see their work, they're addressing both kind of publics who are concerned about surveillance. They're also, frankly, addressing a whole audience of hidden security guards and police who are watching CCTV. So it's very interesting sort of thinking about audience. As Alex Galloway points out, he says, resistance is built into the internet. The examples of software art, open source activities, and network art and politics provide examples of protocols for computer protocol practices. And he, as well as theorists like Elkir Roseanne Stone, Geert Lovink, who's a leader, really, of the open source movement, argue that the internet has opened possibilities for new forms of resistance. Stone proposes that virtual worlds, and we're going to hear a little bit about that later from Femke, provide new opportunities for the expression of new subjectivities through the fusion of body, interface, and virtual worlds. And these are sort of documentary media of great potential. They're fictional and documentary. They kind of collide practices. How are we doing here? Great. Okay. So many participants in online communication are contradictory, protective of their right to contribute to dialogues and to control their data at the same time that they want to shop online, feel secure against terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. So aside from the development of online participatory culture, there are other responses to surveillance. And those who are monitored consistently find ways to resist, as is evidenced by many workplace studies. And in fact, there's really a lot of very compelling documentary about forms of resistance. The internet and its allied technologies are best understood, therefore, as a kind of terrain of negotiation and at times conflict around structures of surveillance, lateral flow, and command and control. So very kind of distributed media, at the same time all kinds of efforts to assert the kind of traditional hierarchy of media. So we can never forget this as documentary producers. This is sort of fundamental to how we understand, I think, our practice in the 21st century. So now the second point, and maybe if you show Keith Piper's work, that would be great. Thank you. The second point that is that we can argue at the same time that there are profound changes in the nature of time. So bear with me as I kind of move through this. We're in a time that we can describe a lot of our daily experience and also our media experience as being full of presence, synchronous as well as asynchronous, highly immersive and thick. We're kind of living thick time, where time is not only moving forward, but we're sort of immersed in it. And you're also polite because you're not sitting here on your mobile phones, your BlackBerries are off, and you're actually not on your computers doing something else, unlike most of the student population these days. So perhaps this doesn't refer to how you live your lives, but for many people, they live in thick time. So philosopher and media theorist Gilles Deleuze proposes that it's only if we rethink time that we'll be able to transform our future and ourselves. He says, through memory concepts, art and philosophy, we can move backwards and forwards through the flow of time. We can think other durations, and we can disengage perception from the apparatus of prompted actions, unquote. He suggests that time should be an explosive force, a glue. He says, time is becoming without ground and without foundation. So great, we're into Horizon Zero. Thank you. Deleuze describes the importance of what he calls the event, a way perhaps of rethinking real-time citizen journalism, location-based or interactive experiences that require the active engagement of audiences. He says there's a present of the future, a present of the present, and a present of the past, all implicated, rolled up in the event, and thus simultaneous and inexplicable. I think he mystifies this a bit. But this sort of notion of how time is changing dramatically in the media that we're working with, I think, is fundamental to us. And I think this is where it's valuable at times to... I'm sorry. I think that the spill on the keyboard somehow moved itself into my throat. How interesting. So I think this is where sometimes resorting to the philosophers can be very helpful. And so in the kind of presentation of images, the order of time is not succession, but in fact a kind of topological experience. So what he's talking about here is the way that, you know, events are thick, that way we live in time is very deep, and that at the same time media is increasingly, frankly, everywhere in the world that surrounds us. So this kind of creates an experience of time that's very much about sort of process, and he uses the term becoming, which we may want to think about as, rather than, you know, thinking about a sort of linearity of time within documentary practice, and particularly I'm talking about new media practice, although you can see the sort of residuals of this in a lot of linear work, to think about the experience of being immersed in documentary as one of becoming, of transformation. There's other philosophers post-Deleuze who've picked this up. Rosie Bridotti, who is a contemporary ethicist, She talks a lot about how time and space are gendered. In other words, that issues of sort of gender identity and the way we experience time really are traditionally quite different from how men and women, biological men and women, socialized men and women, experience time. So she argues that it's important to think about the ways that time, in fact, needs to be disrupted. And she's a very strong sustainability ecology advocate. And she talks about the ways that language is a living matter. And we need to really think about the kind of musical variations in the ways that we kind of construct media, particularly media that engages with issues of ecology and sustainability and has a sort of dialogue with the earth. So her ideas about time encompass not only humans, but living matter. And she says bodies and time, so she means the way that we live our experience, are embodied and embedded entities fully immersed in webs of complex interaction. So I'm raising this sort of philosophical notions, and, you know, bear with me. And I think that you can follow them and sort of take them through to implications, perhaps, and how we think about the sort of language of documentary practice that we want to engage with in this century in order to sort of talk to the ways that lived experience has profoundly transformed. So perhaps a language that, you know, historically is more referenced in the 20th century, mid-20th century, 60s and 70s, maybe we need to return to interrogate this as, you know, producers and directors kind of did to a great extent in the 80s. And I guess one of my quibbles, and I'm sort of putting this forward to you since my job is to kind of, you know, kick off debate here, is first of all this problem of surveillance culture. And then secondly is how, in a sense, the kind of discourses, kind of historical discourses of critical documentary are not really engaged enough in the space of interactive documentary practice. So that's my second point. And the reason I think that's so important is because we live in a context where the experience of time and the ability to kind of intervene within time as a kind of radical proposition is perhaps more important than ever. So are we on One World? Oh, excellent, fantastic, okay. So these ideas about time reflect the immersive nature of verite and real-time events. These arguments suggest that we need to raise questions, as I mentioned, about the form of documentary practice. And they bring us to my third point, which is to look at the sort of movements from documentary realism to sociable media, which is a term Judith Donath from MIT uses to talk about, you know, media that's kind of constructed and very process-driven and is very much about user-based contributions into a context that media makers propose to the user. And then tactical media and also citizen journalism. So many questions come up in this space. Who is a documentary for? Is it to convince others? Is it to empower the participants? Is it an intervention? And within the kind of practices of contributory documentary or user-based experience, where is skepticism? And how do we understand the ability to kind of introduce a sort of rhetoric or dialogue that's self-critical and self-reflexive into these spaces? So in the 1970s, I'm just going to check. I think I've got 7 minutes left or so. Am I okay? Yes?
7 minutes.
Okay, 7 minutes. All right. In the 1970s, documentary split between observation and intervention, in part through the work of ethnographic filmmakers and through a kind of critique of realism. And I've talked a little bit about that in my last conversation about time. And the belief that all knowledge is situated was an idea that ethnographers argued heartily about and eventually believed that the ethnographer had to describe their own biases and be alert to the impact of their presence and to understand the kind of unpredictability of outcomes because of their interventions. Now, early verite directors believed that their cameras, which were set on location for months at a time, were really capturing reality as it unfolded. And this notion began to unravel, in particular through some of the dialogues that Trinity Minha, who is a feminist documentary producer, ethnographer, ethnographic filmmaker, and theorist, she insisted that modern ethnographic filmmakers had a responsibility to consciously represent their own position and to also attempt to construct the kind of cinematic gaze, that is, you know, the kind of understanding that the camera produced from the perspective of those who the camera was studying. So, for example, she shot her films about life in African villages at ground level, as she observed that daily life occurred close to the ground, as she said, and used the movement of a circle as life was organized in a circular fashion. So on one hand, you have this sort of intervention within ethnography, the shift of sort of belief in, you know, we can observe the real, to filmmakers in that space who really revolutionized documentary practice, saying, wait a minute, you know, we're constructing a real. And then the other key direction, of course, for documentary was a kind of interventionist practice, most signified by the Challenge for Change program. So we want to be on the NFB's citizen site here. And radical documentary makers from this perspective perceive themselves as intervening into the context that they were studying, working lockstep with communities that they're researching or, in fact, documenting and empowering them. Part of this practice included the desire to use media to actually shift power, to transform society in not only the way that knowledge was produced, but to actually transform material circumstances within the documentary context. So very far away from notions of a kind of real that you observe. So this meant that documentary subjects participated in even defining and refining the very questions that were asked. And notions of kind of collaborative inquiry into a kind of documentary subject emerged not only in the 60s, but I think are very much current today in terms of how we understand a radical practice within documentary. And you can see it in many of the video works that are part of Hot Docs. So the director, in a sense, in this context, and it's a contradictory term to use the term director, produces context, and leadership kind of moves through the process of making the documentary with everyone taking responsibility, in a sense, for facilitating discourse, discussion, representation, and many of the contributory works now constructed with this kind of philosophy that we're now seeing in the online environment teach people how to use cameras, teach people how to upload content, et cetera, et cetera. So Portrait of the Liberties is an example of this, which you may be seeing right now behind me. So if we then think about user-generated content, however, we have a problem, okay? And I want to leave you with this problem because we're going to move in a moment to just looking for a moment at a Yahoo site that I think is a very interesting sort of emblematic example. One can certainly argue for the need for empowerment and that it's particularly acute in a period where technology is mystified and the processes of its presence and production are idealized. This certainly places pressure on the director to disclose and share not only the ways that content is captured, but the ways that technology structures that experience. But in a sense, you know, users and audiences are way ahead of us, and I think this is our challenge. It's one of the three challenges. There's a shift in the context and the relations of power that has amplified over the last 10 years with accessible and contributory media forms and technologies. Citizens themselves have taken control over the means of production, and almost any context where a documentary producer enters, they will be met with the expectation on the part of your subjects of some form of participation in the process of making media. And there's many examples of this, from the tactical media movement right through to certainly what Yahoo has now become. And there's a couple of examples of work that we're probably not going to get to, but I'll refer you to them, and we can put them up on the site for Hot Docs, that I think are very interesting in terms of sort of looking at tactical media and intervention. And one of them is the Yes Men site. So it's really using almost a kind of realist performance practice and reenactment to incite a situation that then unfolds both in media and in real time. So lots of use of sort of intervention in a documentary context that's highly theatrical. And then secondly, the kind of context of some of the work in YouTube that is in a way a sort of associative discursive structure. So hopefully behind me will be this. Okay, so this is the classic sort of YouTube, you know, environment. And what's very interesting here, of course, is the way that sort of language, you know, and ideas sort of, because it's sort of search engine driven, you know, so you sort of start with the core piece of video and then somebody responds, but then it's associative because it's search based and so and object oriented. So you go off into beautiful Iran and then you've got a whole bunch of videos about beauty and then you've got a whole bunch of videos about skiing. But I thought we should end by just playing like 1.5 minutes of this clip. And it's called Skiing in Iran. And this young man, who is 18 years old, and you know, you won't have a chance because we don't have time to hear his testimony, but I suggest you go and hear him talk about the piece he made. And you kind of ride between thinking, is this irony? Is this serious? But it's quite a brilliant intervention because he went skiing in Iran. He's a Malaysian citizen, and he brought a bunch of his peers from different countries around the world, and they went skiing in Iran. And they talk about their experience skiing in Iran, and it's a counter video to, you know, the incredible amount of American, you know, anti-Iranian content that's now within the global media world. And it's made by an 18-year-old, and it's actually, frankly, quite eloquent and uses a kind of travelogue methodology. And then he kind of deconstructs the video when he talks about its making and his attempt in the first period when it was released to kind of answer, you know, 120,000 emails that he got. So I just want to leave you with these three questions for us to think about over the afternoon. And I know we're going to talk about markets and a lot of the kind of economic issues, but I think as documentary makers, we really have to step back and think about the context we're producing in. We need to think about issues of time and structure and, in a sense, form. And I think we also really need to think about this shift in the kind of ethical documentary to one where, in a sense, users and contributors are taking up that space at times more elegantly than perhaps we're able to. So I'll end there, but we're not hearing him. Oh, well.
Well, thanks a lot, Sarah. I'm Neil Seeling. I'm with the Center for Social Media, American University, Washington, D.C., and I'm going to be the moderator for the debate, and we're going to have some audience participation with this through the vaunted clapometer. You're going to vote for or against the two positions on the proposition that we're going to be having. So, first off, I would like to echo the thank you to Hot Docs for hosting this event. I've been here many times. I've also been to the Banff Center with Sarah. We've had some wonderful adventures, and I like immersing in the thought up in Toronto anytime I come here and everything. And the Center for Social Media is a participant with the Doc Agora Band of Gypsies. I enjoy it, and the center is going to be a supporter in the future. I think I would have to say Doc Agora does a lot of questioning in the old Socratic method without trying to be pretentious. It's a constant questioning of who you are, what you're doing, why you're doing it, unflinching. The gypsy part means you can be like Diogenes walking through town looking for the honest distributor, looking for the honest television executive, which I was with, or at least the executive part, with a Live From Off Center series in the United States. We're a television laboratory. That's a little bit of biographical detail. I also helped launch Link TV, which some of you might know about too, back in 1999 as an alternative public media practice that was born out of a proactive desire to not sit around and complain about PBS as much as we often did. You know, so in that spirit of proactive debate, trying to identify where the trends are going. What does it all mean? I think Doc Agora, it's very much in the Greek tradition of what is at the root of all these great technological changes. And I like thick time. I have to think about this in the middle of the debate, but I think we are in thick time where what does our work mean in that kind of context? So we are going to have, as following, two teams of three people who are going to be arguing for or against the proposition documentary authorship is a dead duck in the digital water. So I'll say it again. Documentary authorship is a dead duck in the digital water. So we are going to have a for team and an against team, each of whom have three speakers. We are starting with the Oxford rules of debate. Whether we hew to them completely, I'm not sure. A band of gypsies has a hard time hewing to anything as if it's etched in stone. But we shall see. And so we're going to have point, counterpoint, and then we're going to have all six people speak. You're going to then applaud one or the other position so we can get your feelings about it. We'll have a question and answer period, and then we have Rudy Boutignol as an adjudicator at the very end. So we are going to have the final word from Rudy, and I hope we'll have collective wisdom at the end of this hour-long process. And thank you for your participation, and we hope that this is an entertaining experience as well as informative. So with that, I'm going to introduce Daniel Cross, who is going to be the first proponent of the four position. Daniel Cross is a documentary filmmaker many of you know better than I do, but he's done a lot of wonderful work with homeless communities in documentary and ongoing activist work all over the place, and very impressive body of work. So again, Daniel Cross for the four proposition. Thank you. Can we get the debaters up here, please? For, against, please.
Cambridge, huh? Okay. Esteemed colleagues, privileged audience. Is that Oxford? I'm fooling around. But we all know the water's poison, so the ducks are all dead. And the authors ain't got no money, so I think we're probably going to win this debate. So I'm for the fact that the author is dead in the digital, dead duck in the digital water. So it's clear, right? I mean, Cameron's a step ahead so far with every single thing that's happened, so he's my boss. A filmmaker whose individual style and complete control over all elements of production give a film its personal and unique stamp. So will the real auteurs please stand up? We won. Okay, so I'll go on. This is documentary. That doesn't feel like a documentary process to me. I think that's I just Googled dictionary, and that's what came up when I searched in auteur. Wasn't searched by me in any way. I think the audience in a documentary context, unless it's really a personal story, and we all cherish that role in documentary filmmaking, gets a little suspicious when the auteur is a little bit too announced as being too privileged or too intelligent or just too in control. We look for in documentaries the opportunity to get closer to the first person lived experience of the people, of the subjects, of our friends that we spend years working together collectively to make our documentary films. Because ultimately, we make documentary films to try to change the world through participatory processes. And the digital world is giving us new and better tools to improve on that. So I think more of like collective, which I'm sure has been up for a minute. We'll just take the first two up there. Formed by collection, forming a whole combined. Again, just randomly Googled. I think that this is a more honest process of how the documentary filmmaker wants to work and share their work with the world. I'm not sure where I am. I'm just letting you think for a minute. But I mean, obviously in documentary, there are layers of authorship. The greatest documentary movement, I think, the most emotive for most creators is the one that happened in the 60s around cinema verite until today, which is the new digital self-participatory peer-to-peer user-generated initiatives. And they very responsibly blurred in their credits the role of the director. And they basically got rid of it for a long period of time. Because how can a director be directing a documentary with 400 hours of footage when it's in the editing room? Nice try. You're not. It's a concurrent relationship. When the cameraman gets inspired to go to the left to follow something, Martin Duckworth is breaking down the road because he's motivated to get an image. He's the author at that particular moment. When the kids start singing that precious song that we all know is what makes the most emotional moment in any good documentary film, the sound recordist is in control at that moment. And later, it's the responsibility of the editorial team in collaboration with the director and the producer. And of course, we all know the commissioning editor will get their word in there as well. So it's obviously a collective process. So anyways, let me just jump ahead to my style. I've made a lot of films, and what I've learned, and I think what a lot of documentary filmmakers actually mature towards realizing, is that the most valuable element or relationship in the process of documentary filmmaking is that relationship with the people that you're working with the community, with the first person, what I call first person lived experience. And being able, like I made a film called The Street, and everybody died in making that film, and then I went around and I distributed it and did Q's and A's by myself. And that was like, okay, people liked the film. I made a film after that called Spit. Not as many people liked the film. But the guy that I worked with, who also had his own camera, who gave you his experience, was with me. And every day we evolved, and every day we had these living relationships with the community. And it just kept going on and on and on and on and on. And that was a collective dynamic process that I think is killing authorship. A website, for instance, that I'm working on, Homeless Nation, where we're giving cameras to street people, and accessing computers so that they can do their own vlogging, video blogging, podcasting, music, spoken word, whatever it is they want. There are certain cells organizing themselves randomly or naturally on there around the most urgent issues: squatting, police brutality, binning, food reclamation. And so what do we do with all that? Well, anyways, naturally, another person steps in specifically at that time who has a better wisdom and a more local expertise to offer a different tool, opensourcecinema.org, and say, well, let's get the international community to put images up, collect images from around the world on police brutality. Or in this instance behind you, just to get off the street, this is a whole gaggle of people who mash up around a specific artist. And let them all edit. Let different versions of the same story exist. Perhaps you, as the particular idea originator, have a strand that you want to edit from images from Brazil, Germany, or Italy, and Canada. But that doesn't mean other people can't also edit those images as well. And that brings us to green. So the green code is up there, Noyan Cameron. And that's not me. I don't know who that is. But it's obvious that it rises up at a specific time. And that's the process that we have to work in at that given time. So I think that's all I'm going to say. And just to maybe double check the room again, will the real auteurs please stand up? Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now the first speaker in opposition to the proposition is Jennifer Fox. Many of you know her work, documentary maker, living out of Manhattan, but gets around the world. You've probably seen her new film. Jennifer is going to be arguing against the proposition, but she also has many web-based elements, and she straddles the line. We were a little worried she might be a double agent in this debate, but we shall see. Jennifer Fox?
Hi. I want to speak more from the heart than a double agent, actually. I believe in authorship completely, totally. I think I live for authorship. I don't think anything new in the world is created without authorship, and I believe that all medicine and all science sits in some way on individual authorship, even as we draw on the collective. Ideas for me are more like dreams. They don't have shape. They don't necessarily, they're not clear, they're fuzzy. And one has to step into the land of dreams in order to create something new. And ultimately, all our lives depend on what is new. If something has already been done, it's easy. I can tell you about it. I can sell it to you. I can show it to you. But if it hasn't been done, and this is where all of our problem lies as so-called artists and authors, how do I tell you what I haven't created yet? How do I show that to you? How do I make you believe in that journey? This is, of course, the dilemma of all of us as filmmakers, and it is our problem. And it behooves us to figure out how to solve that problem, but it's very hard because I haven't taken the journey yet. So even while, as a filmmaker, I'm depending on reality, it is all about my interpretation of reality that makes the difference. And I give you a very simple example. There are 100 people in this room, maybe. Now, if we ask each of you to tell a story about what was happening right now, I guarantee you we would have 100 stories, each unique and different. And for me, that is absolutely a proof of authorship. It doesn't matter that when I go to make a film, not like my most recent film, but say the previous one, American Love Story, I was documenting for a year and a half a real family's life. I was filming it, I was observing it, I was talking to them. But at the end of the day, it is my synthesis and my understanding of their life that shapes it into story, which is so key that then can then get translated and shown to somebody else. That translation, that shape into story, is so important. It is the giving of form. If we don't give things form, we can't understand our lives. And without form, without story, we are lost in a universe that is way too overwhelming, which is why story has existed from the beginning of time, and it is carried all the way to today, so that even though we're using these modern techniques, we're telling very traditional, age-old stories. Ironically, when I made an American Love Story, the subject, Karen, looked at me and said, "That's a really great film, I really like it, but it's not my story. I would tell it differently." And that is true, because I was the author of that story. Even while I was using their life and using their reality as part of that, I really believe in the importance of a singular vision precisely because of how delicate the journey is into the unknown. And it doesn't mean that I don't believe in collaboration. Collaboration is very different than a collective work. Collaboration at its best, as we all know, is when you have people, respected people, who each have a task in which they have some autonomy and they communicate between them within those tasks. And usually, even within a collaborative work, of which we're all engaged in lots with commissioning editors, with editors, with camera people, etc., there is still the necessity for one link. And that is the vision of the author, because who is to tell us where we are going? Why should we go that way versus that way? And the problem, I believe, that when you get too many people into a collective discussion is, in fact, all we can do is tell you what we already know. A good example of that, and you've all had this experience, if you go to pitch a film I suspect it's the same with a novel. When you pitch a film, people will say, oh yes, it's just like that other film I saw. Or isn't it like, oh, I saw that a year ago? Because all frame of reference is always backwards. We can only talk about what we already know. But the author can imagine what doesn't exist yet, even if he or she doesn't know how to get there. That is why what is so important is to allow the spaciness of a journey and to actually trust that that journey will find its way. Now, for me, it doesn't matter what the shape of the object is. An object can be 1 minute, and it can be authored. It can be 10 minutes. It can be 6 hours. It can be 20 hours. The importance for me is that there is a vision behind it that is new and unique, and that is somehow treading ground that has never been seen before. Once you create something, of course, then what we see is form and formula. Once you have a formula, anybody can fill in the blanks. That's what sitcom is. Even though we can have original sitcom, it's very easy to bring a team to write into something that has already been made into formula or is formulaic. However, the new thing is always the first thing. You see it a lot in series, like I always think of Die Hard with Bruce Willis.
Jennifer.
I can't keep talking. Die Hard 1 was a great film. It was a very commercial film, albeit it was new. Die Hard 2, 3, and 4 were crap. And that's because it became a collective. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I really didn't want to stop that, you know, but it's the rules. You know, the Oxford form is basically set up for sophistry where you can argue any position. Something like that. Minute, yep, there you go. There, leave it to Nick to get a little economy of the debaters going already here. And Femke Wolting, I think, to that point, covers both sides. She's the director of Submarine, a wonderful organization in Netherlands that does linear documentaries, does wonderful short dramas and animations and games. So she can literally, she could argue both sides of the proposition, but she's in the four team today. So.
Okay, thank you, Neil. So I'd like first to say that I agree to one little part of Jennifer's statement where she says stories will always be relevant and important. I completely agree with that. But I do think that the people who are going to tell those stories might not be the same people as the authors of today. And that the people who are deciding who are authors, who we should see as auteur filmmakers, might also not be the same people as today is the case. So I'd like to say something about production and distribution. I think about production, it's the age of the auteur because you can do everything yourself. In a digital age, the auteur is the person with the best ideas and the best execution. Traditionally, what we would consider an auteur would be a filmmaker who had access to a broadcaster, had a degree at a film school, and had a sheen of believability. The commissioning editor, who was always, is of course always afraid to spend money on a wrong project, would have the belief that this filmmaker would be capable of finishing a film and delivering something good. And that had also to do with the ability of the filmmaker to convince the broadcaster to do so. So the auteur controlled the documentary space because he was able to convince the commissioning editor that he would be the best person to make the film. Also, he had access to the film funds. He knew the people and he knew the film festival programmers. I know that, for example, years ago, I was a programmer at a film festival Rotterdam. And I know that about 99% of all the films we programmed were from the people that we knew via our network, via. And the thousands of tapes we got, we watched them, but very rarely those were the films that were selected. So you had to know the system in order to be successful as a filmmaker. And also you had to be able to be a professional journalist or filmmaker to be able to have access to information. Because of the internet, there's so much more access to information. You can speak easier to export yourself. You can email them, you can find all their information online, and the barriers to information are also much, much less. So before, in the auteur time, it was all about having a relationship of a relation, having a network of relations. Today, I think it's the auteur is the person with the most talent and the most desire to make films. So viewers, amateur filmmakers have now access to means of production and technology. You can make a film yourself, edit it, and even distribute it from your own desktop. You don't even need a camera anymore. As you can see in a film I produced this year, and that's been selected in competition here at the Hot Docs. I'd like to show a very brief clip of it. It's a film which completely filmed inside Second Life. It's made by Douglas Gayton, and it's called My Second Life. You have to go down on the page, and then click there. Watch documentary, yeah. It's part of a series we're doing called Mini Movies, which are all series of documentaries that consist of several episodes. And so Douglas Gayton made 7 episodes of 7 minutes and re-edited it into a longer film. Do you have sound? You have no sound? Okay, no, thank you. So it's completely filmed inside of Second Life. He made the film basically 7 months spending time in his bedroom, building sets, meeting people, researching the people that he found interesting to make the film about. And basically the film is about his journey leaving the physical world and starting a life in Second Life. So this film was made, and we put a trailer, this first episode, on YouTube, and within days it was number one on YouTube, and it caused such a buzz online that we got many like offers from festivals, broadcasters, and so on. So basically here the audience decided this is something worthwhile. So that brings me to the second point about distribution. Now the great thing that previously, even if you had talented, there were still barriers. Today you just need desire and talent, and YouTube is the best proof of that. YouTube is more accurate in measuring success than any focus group of any broadcaster can do. The 20th century was the age of the Encyclopedia of Britannica. Today we live in the age of Wikipedia. Out of these thousands of amateur filmmakers on YouTube, many of them are crap, but there are also will rise new auteurs that create documentaries that would not have been commissioned for documentary auteur slots on television. Because the commissioning editors, the film festivals, and the funds don't have the network and the expertise to pick up, select, and find these new talents yet. Today, it's up to the audience who decides which filmmaker we will call an auteur.
Great.
In time?
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much, Femke. I'll add parenthetically, the filmmaker Douglas Gayton basically hacked Second Life. You know, there's no two words other than that, you know. Heck, second, three words. So what he's working on now is doing a cinematographic toolkit so other people can go into Second Life and do their own documenting of what's in the 5 million member metaverse. So that is very much in line with some of the stuff that Sarah was talking about with the new reality of what's going on with this stuff. And the other bit with authorship, Linden Lab that created Second Life didn't send out all the king's horses and the king's men to clap him in irons. Rather, they took it as a good thing and, you know, advanced it within the Second Life system. So stay tuned with further developments on that, thanks to Femke and others. So with that, Brad Dworkin is our next speaker in opposition to the proposition. Brad is a student at Ryerson College down the block. He's a precocious student, I have to say, having looked at a lot of his work, including the installation outside the doors here that you can take a look at in the break. So he's done some wonderful, thoughtful, complex multimedia efforts and will speak against the proposition.
Okay, thank you. So unlike many of the people on the panel today, I don't have the same volume of experience perhaps to draw upon because I am a student, but I'll just begin sort of by discussing some of the things that you discussed. So for example, My Second Life and the feeling that, well, that anyone could go into this world and there's this collaboration where people can get together and make these things. I know of a number of other video game-based cinematic experiences. Red versus Blue is one that's quite popular, which is based on the Halo game engine. And ultimately, what I'm going to bring up a little bit later on in my discussion is the idea that within the world of the digital universe, the internet and games and things of this nature, we have to redefine authorship and auteur as it pertains to documentary. So in this case, who would be the auteur of that? Well, I'm going to suppose that the auteur would in fact be the people who created the engine for this this game would have their hand on it because they developed the programming, the aesthetics, and to an extent set the parameters, much like the director of a documentary would. So, to go into my points, first thing I mentioned was, of course, that we have to redefine auteur theory. And I mean, everyone goes based on Bazin, Saris, what they said back in the 60s and 50s about auteur theory. And I'm going to say, I'm going to quote Andrew Saris here. He said that auteur theory itself is a pattern theory in constant flux. And therefore, we have to continually find our new definition of it. And as we move into the digital age, we cannot use the same definition of auteur theory to explain ourselves. So I have an example here, and it's up, very nice. Mob Films, this is a student from Queen's University, Eamon Crudden, his PhD thesis. And what he's doing is collecting footage of protests from all over the world and assembling it here in what he calls an unedited form. And his goal in his thesis, he says, is he wants to efface the effacing of the auteur for the sake of collectivization. So he would be arguing for collaborative authorship. Now, my argument is that while the people submitting are quote-unquote unedited, we have to look at the entire work, not as the film or the television distribution that we would think of in traditional documentary, but in digital documentary, it's the entire work. So the entire website, which contains the work, what Wagner would call the Gesamtkunstwerk, and please excuse my pronunciation on that. We have to understand that by choosing a color scheme for the website and an aesthetic for that, the video codecs, resolution, accompanying layout and text, the technique for comments, he informs the footage much like a director would take a piece of stock footage or archival footage and edit that. If we can go on to the next slide. This is BlogTO, it's a popular blogging site. And again, it's all set up with, I'm looking at a textual sense now. There are limitations, there is a context determined by perceived authors referred to as moderators. The other slide I have is a Facebook group for auteurs, apparently. The terms and the circumstances under which you can develop and share information, it still has a moderator, a person in charge, an auteur of these works. So in the digital world, can we say that the auteur is dead? I don't think so. I think they've just taken a new form, and we need to move beyond purely the film or video inset experience and look at the entire piece, the website itself. I want to talk just finally about the piece that's outside in the hallway. You can take a look at it at the break. Can we go to the last one? Thank you. The piece is called SSDE, and it's my own experiment with collaborative authorship to see if you could find our way to it, if I could find a way to remove the filmmaker from the experience of making a documentary. So it's 20 different feeds of footage of the city all taken at the same time. And what I realized as I was putting it together and trying to not edit it was that the piece itself began to take a form by what I laid out in terms of how it had to be. People had to go and film at a specific time. It had to be in Toronto. The way that it's projected or set up on an HD screen, or if I put it on a projector, the ways in which I altered the footage, I could not remove myself from the filmmaking process. So ultimately, I think that in the way that traditional documentaries are bound by editing, an assertion of the authorial voice, digital documentaries must also be bound by the context of their exhibition and distribution. And I think that's equally subject to the hand of the author. Thank you.
Thank you. It's okay. Thank you very much, Brad. Thoughtful. So again, be thinking about how you're going to vote with your hands in the clapometer sequence coming up. You know, I think, yeah, that's it. Practice, 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 practice. Are you ready to go? Okay, great. Just just making sure. Next speaker, Adnan Hazi.
Okay, it was quite funny to see my project in your presentation.
I know.
Because it is like this collective database we're doing in London, Thetford TV thingy. I just want to show this picture here, because this picture was just exactly a week ago in China. This was a guy who was, you see there, left down, you see Mr. Gates being a little bit shocked about the guy running through the podium with a banner saying free software, open source. And this guy was arrested, and he's now, I think, in jail. We don't know what really happened to him. And Bill is still the richest man. So the Gesamtkunstwerk, I think it's not really the author who is the dead duck. So I kind of must say I agree to the Gesamtkunstwerk, but I think the author is in flux. So there is no author which is positioned as the Gesamtkunstwerk in it. The Gesamtkunstwerk contains the author in the collective. So I would argue that it's not the author who is the dead duck, but it's the copyright. The copyright law is simply dead. Nobody cares about it anymore. This kind of protection of authors in the digital waters, they don't work anymore. And I would further argue that the collaboration or the collaborative media practice can actually engage within the kind of open source stuff you see here, basically using the kind of open licensing schemes, which comes back to the distribution, because you can use this freely, and this is basically a share-like attribution license. I want to show two slides now next. Can we go one more? Yeah, that's great. So I need to read this out because I don't see it. The demand for online video is exploding. We have 100 million videos watched on YouTube every day. 100 million, I mean, imagine this for a broadcaster. So many people. Fox Interactive, Yahoo, Google, YouTube, Viacom, etc. now stream 7 billion videos per month. BitTorrent is in the moment the file sharing or the file format, I must say, number one. This has been taken last week at the conference where we were holding, it was called Television Histories in London at King's College, and it is dealing with television archives and how television archives can open up for the academia. And the next one. This goes into file sharing now. Personal storage and property, personal storage and portability accelerating. Over the past 25 years, we had computer processing performance has increased by the factor of approximately 3,500. Computer memory prices have decreased by a factor of 45,000. Computer disk storage prices have decreased by a factor of about 3.6 million. And that means if we go on like that over the next 13 years, an iPod or a device its size will be able to hold a year's worth of video, 8,760 hours by 2012, only 5 years from now. All the commercial music ever created by 2015, that's in 8 years, and all the content ever created in all media by 2020. Hey, that's only 13 years to go, and then we have everybody, everything. And again, this is the same source, it's the Intelligent Television. It is a conference in London, and it is a project dealing with archive. So let's go back to the second slide, I think. Yeah, it's just, I put this up because that's where I'm coming from. This is the research question we're having, looking into the use of free software. I'm doing a practice-based research on the author versus the collective, which is kind of the main question, and we're looking into the shift of the notion in intellectual property. If you are interested, you can download this book. It's on deadfoot.tv as a PDF file. And I want to say also, can we go to the browser, to the D-Word? I'm also part of a community called DWord. You can look it up. It's dword.com. And it's currently undergoing a reprogramming phase. And it has around 2,000 members. So there is a kind of a critical mass, I think, you could use. And in the moment, Peter Gerard, the coder, is using open source technology from the MIT, developed by the MIT, to transfer our kind of platform into a kind of a open community, let's say it like that, but it's still for documentary filmmakers. And now we go to the fourth slide, I think, because now I have to go back to distribution. Okay. So distribution, file sharing. Basically, this is a quite a nice picture. It's like a file sharing is killing music, and now we make it cross it, and we say it's killing film. But let's go one more. So we can also say, home cooking is killing the restaurant industry, and it's tasty. Through file sharing, open media is a fact today. Many also call it piracy. Today, kids do liberated media practices day in, day out. My brother, who's like 10 years younger, he wants to download everything he sees, re-edit, remix, and also republish it. And he doesn't care about copyright. It's simply dead. So I would say, instead of trying to clamp down these teenagers and criminalize them, can we go to the next one? Because I like this one also. Okay. There is actually one more, but I didn't dare to put it up because it says home fucking kills. Yeah, you know what. Instead of trying to clamp down on teenagers, I would say we should actually really talk about the ethics and best practice guidelines and not criminalize people. And there come. This is first, I think the gap between the auteur and the collective is just overstated. And second, I think that the author is kind of an expert with know-how and wisdom, which is in flux in this collective, and contributes with this know-how to the collective. And third, through the use of open media schemes such as share-alike, attribution content license, we can actually ensure that this creativity is creative documentaries are not left behind. We call it the digital, what was it, digital dust? Okay. Copyrights, okay. Many, how much do I have? Little, okay. Okay, I skipped the copyrights thing now because that's just definition. Let's go to the next one. Okay, this is actually Chris Atten, who wrote the book Alternative Internet, and he calls it, there is a concept which is called usufruct, and that's quite interesting because you could actually apply it to collective production methods also in the creative industry. And usufruct, the American Heritage Dictionary defines it the right to use and enjoy the profits and advantages of something belonging to another as long as the property is not damaged or altered in any way. Which seems obviously applicable to intellectual property issues. Atten, the guy who wrote this book and says Linux is anarchy in action, treats usufruct a little bit more generally and using it to describe how property is loosely shared by a community in order to advance the interests of the community or the interests of the individual. So I want to go to the next slide and just have this quote on, and then I will finish off. This is actually a research which states the video blog as collective documentaries, and basically everybody is blogging nowadays, so we are actually all in this kind of collective on the net, networked in this kind of world. So anybody who is not in the internet could maybe claim not to be an author, but I think anybody using the internet is already part of it. And I want to go to the next page just to show, it's not a page, it's the website Creative Commons, just to show quick, it is has actually a quite an interesting approach, which is using the share-alike attribution license. And it hasn't happened so much in the moment because I think it's a big work to be done, but I would really love to see this going on. And that also means there is actually our next speaker almost belonging to our side because his company is already doing it.
Thank you. The next speaker is Nick Fraser. Many of you know him, editor of Storyville, a crucial slot on the BBC in the media ecosystem. Nick is also an accomplished producer and author. And with that, we'll go Nick Fraser.
Well, this debate is billed as an Oxford debate. And there's certain informal rules about that, that you're supposed to not know anything about the subject when you start it and create some false level of antagonism. And by this stage in the debate, I'm supposed to trash all the people on the other side and praise the people on my own side. So I'll freely admit that I don't know as much as I should do about some aspects of these fantastic presentations. I think actually this is a subject highly unsuited to an Oxford debate because everybody basically agrees with everyone else, in case you hadn't. I'm sure you figured that out a long time ago. Can we never, never talk about dead ducks, please? Can we avoid the subject? Digital water. What the fuck is digital water? You know. Daniel talked to us about auteurs. I think basically people should be, every age has its own bullshitters. and Gilles Deleuze and Baudrillard are surely one of them. I think if we're going to talk about authors, we should use Anglo-Saxon words, or, you know, and we should make the point that authors are basically people who write, and citizens can be authors. Everyone is an author. The notion that you're only an author if you've been through some goddamn film school or your shows at, films are shown at film festival is palpably absurd. Palpably absurd. And in that sense, I'm totally on the side of you lot. I welcome every development in new media because authorship will be spread, as indeed, you know, it was in the early days of the printing press. We all know that. We've all read about that. Right. My proposition is simple. Docs will survive. They will be watched because they're made by individuals or by collectives. Docs made by individuals are usually better than collective expressions of anything, which are usually, but not always, fantastically boring, particularly if they're made by Stalinists. Though ecological collective documentaries are about as boring too. Docs we will love. We will love them very much because they give a coherent account of the world. And the job of all of us in this room is to make sure that more good docs are made and that more of them find larger audiences. Right. I've got a few minutes left, and I want to address this subject through a man I think is a great neglected person. No, it is not Gilles Deleuze, it's not Baudrillard, it's a Canadian, Marshall McLuhan. There was a bullshit side of McLuhan, and that was his utopian Catholic pseudo-Marxist view of media. The premise of this was, he claimed to discover it, but he had at the beginning of his investigations, that there was some sort of mysterious endpoint, a utopian endpoint, where the whole world was united in a sort of Whitman-esque electronic body. He would now call it a digital body, but the argument has not changed. This I see at the back of some really, really long-winded expositions about new media, and I urge you all to abandon this notion. The world is not flat. We are different people. We should acknowledge our differences. We should address them through the communications we make each day, like I'm talking to you, and the work we make. This is why journalism is valuable. This is why documentaries are valuable. Now, side by side in Homo Media McLuhanensis, Torontonensis, or whatever, you know, I'll skip the Oxford stuff, was another more brilliant thinker. The insight of McLuhan was that history did not progress in a straight line, Hegelian style, but it had a crabbed walk. And then if you looked at the history of media, you would find forms that overlapped. At the beginning of the printing press, you know, people looked at stained glass windows and they read text, and that created a certain type of sensibility. It seems to me that if you apply this simple notion of McLuhan's, the contemporary world, you will find that the contemporary world offers almost limitless variations of different type of idioms, of expressions. This is totally wonderful. This is what I dreamt of in the 60s when we talked about these things, but they didn't exist. And the fact is, you can be an author in this new medium. You can be an author in any way you like, and you should be an author. It doesn't matter if what you have to say doesn't fulfill the absurd criteria of broadcasters or film festivals or funders. Just go and do it. And therefore, please vote for the greatness of documentaries and the continuing validity of authorship.
Well, thank you very much. I think I can speak for Dr. Gore in taking the critique to heart about perhaps we were too enamored of the rapture of the rupture with saying something is dead. I'll put it that way. You know, but that is the proposition as you consider your vote, whether documentary authorship is a dead duck, not having a bad day, not well-meaning, but under-equipped, but dead duck in the digital water, which, you know, that is the proposition. So I think, get ready, we're going to, like, 3 seconds, we're going to vote for the proposition and then against, using your hands. I think voices, who knows, we're not going to throw you out of here if you do this. So, okay, get ready. In favor of the proposition, documentary authorship is a dead duck in the digital water. Opposed to the proposition, authorship is a dead duck in the digital water.
Wow. Now. Now before
you stand up and admit it.
Yeah. That's a very good question. And you know, before the against team gets feeling too sassy, we do have Rudy Butignol as the adjudicator, and he might or may or may not agree with you. And let me ask real quick, do we have any time for questions, or have we kind of lost it? Okay. So Rudy is the adjudicator. He's taking all of this in and will render an opinion. We have time for a couple of questions, given the very short presentations. You know, anything as to the positions, things that you saw, please. But and I think we have mics coming down the aisle. Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm just struck by the use of the word Stalinist. It's like throwing a grenade somewhere and then expecting people to say, oh, all right, I know where I need to stand. I mean, that's actually really ad hominem. Anyway, the point is, I think, I'm sorry?
May I respond?
No, not yet. Let me finish. Thank you. The point is, I think that a lot of the underpinnings, I'm surprised the philosophical underpinnings actually haven't been talked about, and that is that hyper-individualism is destroying the world. I mean, there's not a single person over here who won't claim to be a so-called environmentalist. And if we go to the underpinnings of, well, you want to call it capitalism, which is a much better word, but nevertheless, if we go and we talk about hyper-individualism, I mean, that is the same kind of, in my opinion, the same kind of impetus that feeds the notion of the auto, this unique individual who stands behind everything, right? And the fact is, until 400 years ago, and, you know, those were troubled times, but until 400 years ago, the whole notion of the individual did not exist in the same way that we know it now. And to think, I mean, especially for a Western audience, I'd be very curious to know how other people in other cultures would address the idea of the individual author. I mean, so it is a historical, it's a social construct, and it's historically constructed, you know, and to pretend otherwise, I think, is a conceit.
Carry on. Other comments raised in the back, sorry, okay. Yeah, I was gonna mention when we were circulating questions talking about Roland Barthes' death of the author, and I don't know if he's a bullshitter too, but you know whether, okay. Oh, there we go. Okay.
Before the digital age, we sat around the campfires, and who are the authors of these native stories that went down from generation to generation to generation? And they had no other memory than to help tell the story. They belong to the people.
Yeah. Just wait a moment. Is there not anybody for the author now? I
mean, other questions? Raise hand. Okay, we have one here.
He just wants a commission, that's all. With Nick. Don't cheer for anything he says.
Right here with glasses. So I'm privileging people with not so much hair and glasses. So.
And we seem to both like purple. I just want actually to jump to a follow-up on that last point and going back to the McLuhan mention. And we're in Innes College. Innes was a colleague of McLuhan. But at any rate, my favorite quote from McLuhan is, artists for society are like the canary in a coal mine, meaning they see forward and they show us the directions. And going back to technology and authorship, and if you go back to Gutenberg, even before Gutenberg, to the pen, to writing, and even the feather, how people used to write. So basically, today we have more and more technology, and before technology it was orally transmitted. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that having a pen, does that make you having a pen, a feather, a beautiful gold fountain pen? Does that make you a good poet? And these days, we've got a lot of technology allowing people to produce content, but it's like a pen. What are they doing with it? That's the question, and I think that's where authorship lies. If I have a beautiful golden pen, can I write better than someone that just has a pencil? Not really. So that's just the reflection I'd like to make.
Great. Thank you. Two more questions, and then we'll move on. Anybody else? Okay. Well. Mr. Adjudicator, have you read, heard, and seen enough to render an opinion? This is, as everybody knows, Rudy Butignol. I think you could do a very interesting collective biography of Rudy, it seems. Everybody's got a Rudy story or some little telling biographical detail. For now, his current incarnation is CEO and president of the Knowledge Network, and he will have the final word. Thank you.
Thanks. When I realized what I was supposed to do, I thought it was outrageous because in terms of an adjudicator on this subject, I certainly wouldn't ask me. Because my bias is so strong in one direction as opposed to the other. However, as I was given the task to adjudicate and to listen to the arguments carefully, I heard some of the same stories, some of the things that I believe in passionately, and I heard some new insights. And I heard some arguments against the proposition itself. And perhaps I shall go through some of the comments from the individuals, and I guess I'll start with you, Daniel. I love your passion, as I always do, Daniel. However, I thought your reliance, your two definitions both came from Google, and I thought you could have exerted a little more effort and gone to a second source. So I thought that was important. I thought that your argument about collaboration was a good one. I'm not sure that it argued for the proposition itself, but for something else. And I think that was really valuable, and I understand where your passion comes from. That's good. In terms of asking people to self-identify, the fact that no one stands up and says they're an auteur does not mean they do not exist. Perhaps they're out there busy creating something. We don't know. We don't know because we haven't polled the audience. But I love your passion. I think it's great. Jennifer, well, clearly articulated. I think it was a good delineation of the issues. You brought up some good examples, and you used my favorite word of the day, which is synthesis. I love synthesis, so she got bonus points just for using that word. And I thought your explanation was really good, and your visualization of what authorship is with your own work was very good, and you used one of my favorite examples. I haven't heard anybody else use Die Hard. I love Die Hard 1, and I always thought with Die Hard 2, whoever made it didn't see Die Hard 1. So you got that. I thought your ending was a little weak. Your conclusion was not crisp and come to, you ran out of time. You needed about 12 minutes for yours, right? I think you needed a little sharper conclusion there. Femke, I thought you made a good point that I hadn't heard before, and that was not the necessary delineation between story and the necessity of authorship. The stories have to come from authors, and I thought that was a point that I hadn't considered, and it started me thinking, and I thought that was great, that they don't have to be mutually inclusive. So that was a new point. But I wasn't clear whether just because someone was an amateur, could an amateur not be an auteur? So I didn't really quite understand that. And I also felt that you didn't really argue against the proposition, but more towards an alternative. Although I really liked your examples of YouTube, and one of the insights that I gained from yours was, again, the aspect that at least with YouTube, you have this incredibly accurate measurement. What it tells us, we don't know, but it's yet another bit of a tool that we can use. And the example of Second Life, that was interesting. I'd heard about it. I like the way that you described it. Brad, I actually accidentally clapped for you at the end of it, and I realized, oh my God, I'm the adjudicator. Maybe I shouldn't have clapped. And I really liked it because you actually redefined the locus of authorship, that perhaps just because it's not located in the same place doesn't mean it's not there, and that perhaps in the new media, the concept, like in video games and in Facebook and YouTube, that really the authorship is somewhere else. And just because we can't find it or don't know where it is or we haven't been trained to look at it doesn't mean that it's not there. I thought that was a genuinely new insight. And at the Knowledge Network, I really want to look at the internet, and I'd love to pick your brain about that and, looking for new people. So, great. I think you're... So I like that. Adnan, you set aside the argument, the proposition itself, and said it's not about ownership, it's not about authorship, it's about ownership. And I think you touched on a really critical issue that really has confounded everyone. Of course, in new media, the one thing that we do know, the people that do make money are the connectivity companies. The telephone companies really don't give a damn what you say, as long as you keep saying it on your cell phone or on your internet service, because this stuff isn't for free. And I think that you really pointed us in a really important new direction. But of course, you didn't argue about the proposition itself. I thought your speculation that the facts that you provided in order to the idea that in 5 years all the media ever created could fit in your storage device was in 15 years was audacious, but it was also exciting. And I thought you brought up a lot of good examples of the growth of the digital universe, and I thought it was the clever reversals, although, you know, did home cooking kill restaurants? No, but did restaurants kill home cooking? I thought I would have liked to tease that around a bit. Nick, I thought you were, I loved your audacious trashing of the proposition itself, and I thought it was the most engaging one in terms of the audience reaction, so that always is interesting. And of course, you also quoted my favorite philosopher of the day was Marshall McLuhan, and which I think is relatively it's
sucking up to the audience.
Yeah, well, you wait.
It's the other
see.
Part of the Oxford debate.
But you introduced the idea of coexistence of modes of expression. You showed your preference for one, the individual versus the collective. However, you did talk about the coexistence of it. And so, you know, I am, as I said at the beginning, very biased towards the author. In fact, in my career, I like to think of myself as a supporter of the author. However, I'm always, and then when I saw the audience support one side versus the other, I'm always suspicious of going with popular opinion, you know, because I agreed with it. And when I'm terribly in agreement, I think, you know, what else? What else is new? Just because everybody agrees with it, is that the way to go? No, I'm not rescinding the job offer. That's from a sales agent, by the way. Typical, you know. So I thought that the winner was the argument is dead. And that, as Hubert Reeves, the philosopher, said, you know, chaos and order do coexist, and that there are different modes of expression, and just because we don't know how to name them, just because some of our speculation is incredibly wild, and doesn't mean that there isn't something interesting there. And I have to say that I'm going to call it a draw, in the sense that, you know, that I think that Nick made a really good argument actually supporting this side. It is, well, no, it's not. It's, Mike, to be Canadian would have been to go with the overwhelming response from the crowd. I think that it's important to listen. I think the two coexist, and because one, we've had 100 years to talk about fiction, nonfiction filmmaking. We've had very few years to talk about this other one, and I think the fact that there's room for lots of exploration. I'm going to say that that the proposition offered today is dead. So. That's my adjudication. So,
thank you so much. Thank you, audience. Thank you, panel and adjudicator. And per the green code that was talked about earlier today, no ducks were hurt in the making of this debate. So there we go. Thank you very much, Peter. Go ahead with the next stage of the conversation.
Is Samantha in the room? Samantha. Just before we have a kind of formal coffee break, we wanted to bring up Dean Jensen, who's working with a really interesting group called the Participatory Culture Foundation out of Cambridge, Boston area, and on a really kind of important piece of software, I think, that might actually transform the word and proposition called television, and it's called the Democracy Player. Has a new, like all these beta developments, now has a new kind of name called Miro. Like Yoast, I don't know if you've heard about Yoast, but it's the thing that I think will probably kill television. But the democratic version, we'll say, of Yoast, without the kind of capitalization of the Viacoms, but a thing which I think is far more valid as technology, again, destroys us. Is the Democracy Player. So we'll get Dean up for just a five-minute little soupçon, little titillation, and then release those of you who want into the coffee area for 20 minutes, but those of you who want to really know and get deeper into the democracy player can come up and you can mingle, but he'll do a kind of a 15-minute presentation while everybody's at coffee or wanting to stay. Dean Jensen.
Hi, thanks. That's a tough act to follow, but I'll just introduce myself. I'm Dean Jensen. Work for the Participatory Culture Foundation. We're a nonprofit that's modeled after the Mozilla Foundation, which are the people that do Firefox. And we create a free and open source desktop application that's sort of a democratic version of TV is what we're going for. And this is it. So this is something that you can download for Mac, Windows, or Linux for free. And let me begin by talking about sort of what's going on under the hood before I get too much into what's going on up on the screen. So everyone's probably familiar with podcasting, and the next logical step is video podcasting or video blogging. And all of these technologies run on top of something called RSS, which is just an open protocol for creating a feed of media, be it text or video or audio. So the democracy player, can grab any RSS feed with video inside of it and turn it into a channel. So the easiest way to think of it is sort of like TiVo meets podcasting. So if you have an address of an RSS feed, you can manually input it into democracy, and then it turns into a channel up on the left side. Do you want to jump into a channel for me? Okay, so this is Jet Set Show. Will you click on Show 12 More, or 63 items maybe? Yeah, the blue bar. Okay, so this is what a channel looks like inside of democracy. And anytime, it sort of works like a TiVo. You can leave it on overnight. Anytime a new piece of media comes in, democracy is going to automatically grab it and download it. And some of the advantages of this are that democracy can play any format of video from anywhere on the internet. So if you have favorite video blogs or sources to get video from, you don't have to go out and find all of these things every time you want to see if there's new media. All the video comes directly to you. The sort of important thing about this is that we're trying to keep video sort of distributed on the internet. Right now, there are a lot of corporations trying to create sort of walled gardens, like iTunes Movie Store, or YouTube is a sort of a walled garden. These little islands of content where you have to go to them to be able to get it. And we're interested in keeping the internet video spectrum sort of wide open so that if a creator wants to put their video anywhere, then a viewer can get it easily and nicely like this. Do you want to just play something? And the other thing is, when you're downloading the video with democracy, you can do HD because you're not streaming the video. This is something that someone could turn on and leave on overnight. The other advantage that we have is that we can use peer-to-peer BitTorrent. So actually, I believe this feed itself is a BitTorrent feed. If you want to maximize it, just click on the screen. Yeah, so you can get really good, crisp video through the internet this way. And so let's see, where am I in this? It's really hard. I was hoping to have the computer in front of me and be able to do this myself. But let me see. Oh, okay, so how do you find channels on it? How do you find, you know, if you don't want to go around finding video blogs all the time, go up to the channel guide. This is what a person will see when they first turn it on. And this is an open directory of RSS feeds that are all, you can single click on any of them. Just show how to add a channel. So if you want to see Robert Scoble, you just click Add, and it gets added onto your channels. This is something that anyone can submit their RSS feed to. We've got a team of volunteer moderators that sort of check and make sure the feeds work right. We do a little bit of, I mean, if there's blatant copyright violation, if someone's putting episodes of Lost up or something like that, we can't put that on. But basically, we try and keep it as open as possible. And the software underneath the channel guide, we just rewrote it, but we're going to be releasing that as an open source module that someone could install, and so they could do their own channel guide. So we're just sort of trying to limit the number of gatekeepers there are in the internet video field, and we think this is sort of a key way to do that. And again, it all runs on open source and open standards, so this is stuff that is interoperable with other feed aggregators. I mean, yeah. Are there any really quick questions? I mean, I'm not sure if I'm missing anything here. Broadcast machine. That's actually, okay, so on the production, or on the publishing side, we have a tool called Broadcast Machine that we're actually not really supporting anymore, but that I am working with Harvard Law's Berkman Center in order to create an open source publishing tool called the Open Media Library, which would allow someone to install almost like a YouTube in a box that they could host on their own machine or their own server somewhere and distribute high-definition video that's really easy to watch and easy to get with like Democracy or any other RSS aggregation software. Which Open Media Library. We're still getting funding for it, so it's not in production yet.
What's the access
to this? Getdemocracy.org.
Democracy.
Get Democracy. Actually, .com works too. So getdemocracy.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, there's going to be an opportunity for those who want to ask questions and get really into it. Nick and the commissioning editors have been for 4 years doing a 10-hour linear series on democracy, the concept of democracy, international co-production. This is a way that every one of you here can, as we determined earlier, are an author, but now you can become your own network using this kind of stuff. So we'll have a break for about 20 minutes. Those of you who need to, there's coffee and stuff in the corridors. You can look at Brad's multi-authored, not authored piece, which is right out that door. And Dean will be here to, for those who want to get more into the democracy, player participatory culture, in about 3 or 4 minutes, be right back here.